Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Riot hit Ferguson, sees a second night of unrest, and Nigeria devalues its currency. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The Midwestern U.S. town of Ferguson saw a second night of unrest, and solidarity demonstrations were held nationwide to protest a grand jury's decision to not indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. More than 2,000 National Guard soldiers have been deployed in Ferguson to guard against fresh racially charged riots, which broke out late Monday after it was announced that charges would not be filed against Officer Darren Wilson. A tense moment occurred on Tuesday when a group of protesters smashed the windows of and set fire to a police car in front of Ferguson City Hall. Hong Kong authorities cleared a main protest camp Wednesday and arrested two leaders of the Occupy movement, which is calling for greater democracy in the Chinese territory. Police hauled away several protesters, including student leaders Lester Shum and Joshua Wong, during the several-hour operation to clear barricades from the road in Mong Kok neighborhood. Scuffles broke out when some of the protesters tried to prevent workers from tearing down those barricades. Nigeria's central bank has devalued its currency and raised a key interest to stabilize Africa's largest economy amid falling oil prices and ahead of national elections next year. With oil trading below $80 a barrel for the first time in 4 years, the Central Bank of Nigeria this week acted to steady the economy in the run-up to February's presidential elections. This is VOA News. Following the recent United Nations resolution condemning the dire human rights situation in North Korea, the South Korean parliament is now considering taking action on the issue. VOA's Brian Patton reports.
The two major political parties in South Korea have somewhat diametrically opposed views on North Korea. The ruling conservative Saenuri Party supports cautious dealings with the secretive and authoritarian Kim Jong-un regime. The bill it is sponsoring in parliament would provide funding for North Korean human rights and civics groups operating in South Korea and would empower the Justice Ministry to document human rights violations in North Korea. Since 2005, there have been a number of South Korean legislative proposals to address the dire human rights conditions in the North, but until now there has not been a strong enough consensus across party lines to pass a bill. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
The UN Security Council's patience with the two sides in South Sudan's deadly year-long conflict appeared to be running out on Tuesday. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
Australia's UN Ambassador Gary Quinlan told reporters the council is very concerned about the political crisis that has killed thousands, left nearly 2 million people displaced, and 100,000 sheltering in makeshift UN protection camps. Ambassador Quinlan laid the blame for the misery squarely at the feet of President Salva Kiir and his political rival and former Vice President Riek Machar.
This is a man-made disaster and a violent power struggle between the two chief architects in South Sudan's political elite. It can be stopped if they were to move back from the current pursuit of their own selfish, narrow political interests, and that's the united view in the Council.
Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker says a $380 billion stimulus is needed to restore the European Union's economy and to show the world that Europe is back in business. The European Commission chief said Wednesday that $26 billion in seed money would flow from EU institutions under the proposal to improve investor confidence in Europe, where massive government debt has undermined an investment market recovery. The proposal is to be discussed by the 28 EU leaders at a December 18th-19th summit. Gunmen opened fire on a polio vaccination team in southwestern Pakistan Wednesday, killing at least four people and wounding several others. Police say that three female health workers are among the dead. The incident occurred in Quetta, the capital of Baluchistan province. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Ruhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
On November right now, the last time I stopped counting, it was over 1,400 in just the month of November, and that is the highest within a single month. I'm sure now it could even go above 1,500 at this point, because every day the numbers are increasing. There is no positive trend to see the numbers are decreasing.
That's Mohamed Sila, Country Director for International Aid Agency ActionAid in Sierra Leone. He says the Ebola virus continues to spread throughout the country. We'll have details coming up.
Also in the news, the U.S. and the U.N. are condemning increasing attacks against civilians in the DRC's North Kivu province.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Ghana in our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Ebola virus continues to ravage Sierra Leone despite ongoing efforts by the government and international community to contain it. The country's president has made the virus a top priority on his agenda, scaling down other projects that were to be implemented. He has also committed over $20 million U.S. dollars to fight the disease. ActionAid's country director in Sierra Leone, Mohamed Sila, says the Ebola virus persists with the highest number of new cases reported to date this month.
On November right now, the last time I stopped counting, it was over 1,400 in just the month of November, and that is the highest within a single month. I'm sure now it could have even go above 1,500 or 600, because every day the numbers are increasing. There is no positive trend to see the numbers are decreasing. Now we have a lot of treatment facilities. Now we have more laboratories, but yet there are still some of the major towns that are being affected that do not have access to laboratories. So that's a big challenge. The numbers are still increasing amidst all the efforts.
So far, six doctors and over 100 frontline health workers have died from Ebola. What is the situation now regarding health workers? Do they have the necessary equipment and protection they need? And are there enough health workers in Sierra Leone right now battling Ebola?
We have a lot of health personnel. I mean, recently, even there were some volunteers from the UK that also came in. We have the Cubans on the ground. We have the Chinese on the ground. Like that, we are just overwhelmed by the enormity of the challenge. Actually, we have lost seven doctors. And even this week, again, there was a report about two doctors have got infected again. One is an Italian that has been taken out of the country, and another one that's a national is still within country and being treated. So this is a very, very huge task for the health personnel.
What is needed now to reduce the spreading of the disease?
One of the key challenges I think we are facing currently, we do not have enough laboratories in all the districts. Ideally, it would have been nice if you have laboratories in each district so a suspected case can be quickly isolated, result is positive, and they can be taken to a treatment or holding center. Secondly, the holding facilities are overflowing. We do not have enough bed space to accommodate all the sick people that are currently showing signs and symptoms. That's another big challenge. And thirdly, because of the large number of people that are picking up the disease and you need to quarantine a lot of houses, there are many houses where Ebola victims have been picked up that have not been quarantined because we don't have enough security deployed to such places and they have not been supplied with food. The people who leave the houses, they will move out of being isolated for 21 days because they are not being provided with food. And even up to now, the time it takes for positive results to come back to communities and therefore all those who are we associated with that one positive person to be isolated and actually secure so that they do not move. And unfortunately, there is a lapse in the security system. I just give an example of Kenema District, which had been isolated in August, and they had been doing very well at the district level. They had no new infections for nearly 1 month, and then we had a case. How did it happen? No one knows. Of someone who is infected moving out from Freetown to enter an isolated zone that she was not supposed to enter. How she entered there, no one knew. Definitely a weakness in the systems of allowing people to go into the zone that they are not supposed to enter.
How is Sierra Leone's government addressing these issues, as well as how is the international community responding to these major challenges?
The Sierra Leone government has been doing a lot even before the international support started coming in, and now for sure the one major thing they are confronting is how to coordinate all the support that's coming out from different sectors. Another challenge that could be facing is when some of the international funding that is coming is not going through government, it's going through different international NGOs and international institutions like the UN body. How to actually coordinate and have a grasp of the whole situation is a big challenge. I'll just give a simple example. In some districts where you have people who are responsible for handling corpses are being paid by international NGOs. In another case, you have situations where they are being paid by government. And so if there's a delay in payment of those that are handled by government, you see strikes. I mean, health workers who have not been paid displayed corpses of dead Ebola patients outside of the hospital as a sign of protest. And these are people that have been managed are supposed to be paid by government, and they have not been paid for over a month.
People's attitudes towards Ebola has also been very challenging over these months in trying to contain the virus. What do you see now as some of the biggest challenges in getting people to follow direction? And also, what is their attitude towards people who have been former Ebola patients?
What I can say probably has changed a bit is the acceptance of Ebola survivors. But what I've still not seen is the attitude of people. People still have the negative attitudes of doing the wrong things that will make them continue to get infection. We still have the challenge of people hiding sick people within their houses. We still have the challenge with, I was even a very bad scenario recently when people had to go and exhume a dead Ebola body because they said they had to perform special traditional rites on the corpse. And that was even being championed by a local chief. So it just shows we still have a big challenge in the social mobilization to effectively get everyone on board. We all know if people have the positive attitude, we could easily tackle it. But ideally, even if we got all the hospitals and with all the facilities here, people don't change their attitude, we cannot easily get rid of the disease.
That was Mohamed Sila, Country Director for ActionAid. He spoke with me from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The head of the UN Ebola Emergency Response Mission says new infections in Sierra Leone have delayed the goals of treating more patients and increasing the rate of safe burials. UN envoy Anthony Banbury had predicted the isolated treatment and safe burial would reach 70% by December 1st. The UN mission failed to reach that goal because of increasing cases in rural parts of Sierra Leone, the city of Makini, Port Loko, and the capital of Freetown. In neighboring Liberia, public gatherings were banned last month while hundreds of Liberians were contracting the Ebola virus each week. The ban continues even though the rate of new infections has slowed to about 100 per week. However, political candidates campaigning for the Senate election on December 16th are exempt from the ban. Meanwhile, at Langley Air Base in the U.S. state of Virginia, 90 U.S. military personnel have just returned from Liberia. They will now remain in isolation for 21 days. They will celebrate their traditional Thanksgiving holiday in relative luxury at the military base. They can watch big screen television of American football games while they wait for the end of their quarantine. They were among almost 2,000 military personnel and contractors sent to Liberia and Sierra Leone to build isolation and treatment centers.
Coming up on 14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The U.S. and the U.N. are condemning increasing attacks against civilians in the DRC's North Kivu province. They say at least 200 people have been killed since mid-October near the city of Beni. Women and children were among the victims. The attacks included beheadings, rapes, and mutilations. The U.S. State Department says the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, and others allegedly carried out the attacks. It says the ADF is an illegal Ugandan armed group.
UN humanitarian officials say civilians are bearing the brunt of Somalia's conflict. They say more than 5,000 weapons-related injuries have been reported by 9 hospitals this year in Mogadishu, Kismayu, Dulo, Mudug, and Baidoa. Meanwhile, about 50,000 people have been affected by seasonal flooding along Somalia's Shabelle and Juba rivers. Around 30,000 of them have been displaced. Iran is the worst hit of the 6 regions affected by floods. The UN says humanitarian agencies are distributing to the needy hygiene kits, plastic sheeting, kitchen sets, blankets, and shelter materials, among other items. In other news, on Somalia, about 9,000 suspected cases of measles have been reported this year. That's double compared to last year. The UN says there are large numbers of unvaccinated children in hard-to-reach areas in southern and central Somalia.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Ebola virus continues to ravage Sierra Leone despite ongoing efforts by the government and international community to contain it. The U.S. and the U.N. are condemning increasing attacks against civilians in the DRC's North Kivu province. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The UN Security Council's patience with the two sides in South Sudan's deadly year-long conflict appeared to be running out yesterday. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports the council is closer to imposing targeted sanctions on the parties.
Australia's UN ambassador Gary Quinlan, who's president of the 15-nation council this month, told reporters the council is very concerned about the political crisis that has killed thousands, left nearly 2 million people displaced, and 100,000 sheltering in makeshift UN protection camps. Ambassador Quinlan laid the blame for the misery squarely at the feet of President Salva Kiir and his political rival and former vice president Riek Machar.
The fact is, this is a man-made disaster and a violent power struggle between the two chief architects in South Sudan's political elite. It can be stopped if they were to move back from the current pursuit of their own selfish, narrow political interests, and that's a united view in the council.
He said the council decided some time ago that it is prepared to move forward with targeted sanctions if necessary, possibly including an arms embargo, and that some members have discussed possible measures among themselves. Peace talks between Mr. Kiir and Machar in Addis Ababa under the auspices of regional group IGAD have so far not delivered any deal. Ambassador Quinlan said the council has been taking its lead from IGAD and had given its mediators space to work toward a November 24th deadline for reaching an agreement. With no accord in sight, the council now will have to consider other options. Earlier Tuesday, during a vote to renew for another 6 months the 12,500-member UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan, that country's envoy, Francis Madang Dang, warned the council that a sustainable solution to the conflict cannot be achieved through sanctions. He said they only tend to harden positions toward confrontation rather than cooperation. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Nigeria's central bank has devalued its currency and raised a key interest to stabilize Africa's largest economy amid falling oil prices and ahead of national elections next year. Chris Stein has more from the capital, Abuja.
With oil trading below $80 a barrel for the first time in 4 years, the Central Bank of Nigeria this week acted to steady the economy in the run-up to February's presidential elections. Nigeria is Africa's largest oil producer, and the government generates 70% of its revenue from oil. The drop in global prices, caused in part by increased production in the United States and slowing demand in Asia, has become a cause for concern. The finance ministry last week announced it would rein in expenditures and place new taxes on luxury goods. The central bank on Tuesday lifted interest rates to 13% from 12%, and raised its official peg for the Naira to 168 against the dollar from 155 previously. Bismarck Rawani heads Financial Derivatives Company, based in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. He says the central bank's moves are positive steps to keep the economy under control.
I think it was a move in the right direction, but I'm not sure that it is, completely adequate, but it moves towards equilibrium.
However, devalued currency means businesses and individuals who get paid in Naira but pay bills in foreign currencies will end up spending more. Both the government and Nigerians who work overseas will find doing business more expensive.
Even Nigerians whose kids are in schools overseas will have to bring them back in some cases where they cannot afford to do it anymore. So there, you see the adjustments are both at the government, corporate, and individual levels.
Nigeria this year became Africa's largest economy after it changed the way it calculates its gross domestic product under President Goodluck Jonathan. Mr. Jonathan is running for re-election in February, and Rouhani says the drop in oil prices means the ruling People's Democratic Party will have to do more to prove it's worth the voters.
The PDP will have to work much, much harder to convince people that they are in charge of things and they can control things, and that the future is going to be better than the past. Because it actually just makes people more desperate.
Rouhani also warns that inflation may tick up in the new year, raising prices for consumers as the election grows near. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Climate watchers will be focused on Lima, Peru, December 1st as representatives of 200 countries gather for crucial negotiations on a new climate treaty. It would replace the Kyoto Protocol, the global agreement that expired in 2012. As VOA's Roseanne Skirball reports, hopes for success in this round of talks are boosted by recent agreements among the world's top polluters.
The meeting in Lima sets the stage for Paris in 2015, when nations will come together to agree on a binding climate treaty, says Jennifer Morgan, global director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute.
That all countries would be part of, which is one of the differences of the past, and that would stick around for a while. That would be a global agreement for decades to come. That would bring countries back to the table to strengthen their commitment to solving the problem.
Scientists affirm with increased certainty that the planet is getting hotter. Study after study shows that the world is well on its way toward a 2 degrees Celsius rise in temperature above pre-industrial levels. Experts say that would trigger extreme weather and rising seas, problems of global magnitude. The studies also show that climate-changing emissions from fossil fuels are to blame. Lima is about getting those emissions in check. Morgan points to growing momentum to get that done. In September, the United Nations held a climate summit to engage heads of state and industry leaders, and about 700,000 people crowded streets in New York City and elsewhere for the People's Climate March.
Then bounce into European heads of state in October saying, here's our offer to reduce at least 40% emissions. And then the U.S.-China announcement recently, where those two countries came forward in a pretty historic announcement of what they're willing to do on their numbers and their willingness to work together.
In that agreement between the world's top polluters, the U.S. committed to reducing emissions between 26 and 28% by 2025. And for the first time, China put a timetable on its actions, saying emissions would peak by 2030. Morgan says to get there, China must begin making massive cuts now.
It's not like they're going to wait 16 years. They actually have to shut down coal-fired power plants. They have to build up renewable energy. They have to be much more efficient in order to turn that curve.
The deal puts China in a leadership role for the first time. Other countries are expected to put their reduced emissions commitments on the table by March. Morgan says the U.S.-China announcement is a strategic move that could energize other nations to do more.
If you look at developed countries, it's fair to say that Australia or Canada haven't indicated when they are going to table their offer. Well, if China can offer something, certainly they can offer something too. And in developing countries, I think a country like India or Brazil, I think now are challenged to table their offers as well.
Morgan says it's critical to close the emissions gap between what is needed and what countries are expected to pledge. She says each nation will make reductions in its own way through national policies and laws, but only a global pact with binding commitments can exert pressure to get the job done.
So it's in the interest of every country to actually have a global approach so that they can be sure that what they're doing is being mirrored by others. You don't get that through bilateral deals. You don't get all of the emissions in place, and you don't take care of the most vulnerable countries around the world adequately. So you need to do this global. It's challenging, it's messy, but it's fundamental to move forward.
Morgan hopes that the Lima meeting will end with a text for a new treaty, one that will guide negotiators and lead governments to act. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The International Monetary Fund says Egypt is on track for economic recovery after 4 years of severe political and social instability. An IMF delegation in Cairo says that new economic objectives established by the government of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi could achieve an economic growth rate of 3.5% in the coming months. Since the 2011 Arab Spring uprising, Egypt's growth rate has been about 2%. In other news, Cairo opened the Gaza border for 2 days to let stranded Palestinians return to Gaza. The military is demolishing hundreds of homes on the border to create a blockade against terrorists and arms smuggling. Cairo began building the blockade when 30 Egyptian soldiers were killed in a rocket attack last month.
Hundreds of prisoners have taken over the main jail in the Central African Republic capital of Bangui. Security forces and international peacekeepers quickly surrounded the prison, and the United Nations mission in the country says the prisoners cannot escape. Nick Long has more from Bangui.
There were and may still be more than 700 prisoners inside Garagba Detention Center, a jail built for only 300. The prison has seen breakouts in the past year, and the UN has been warning in recent weeks that conditions inside the jail might lead to further trouble. On Monday, that trouble erupted. The prisoners, some with weapons, took over the jail, exchanged gunfire with security forces outside the facility, and demanded talks with the head of the CAR Prosecution Service. One of the policemen standing guard outside the jail told VOA, on condition of anonymity, what he thought had sparked the protest. He says one of the prisoners died of tuberculosis, so the prisoners have, as he puts it, gone on strike. They are demanding their rights, he says, as some of them have been held there for 10 months without trial. The policeman also said some prisoners had been firing at peacekeepers and throwing grenades, and one Burundian peacekeeper had been wounded. As of midday Wednesday, the situation was calm, but the standoff continued. Police Lieutenant Leo Frank Gnapier is with the UN mission in the CAR.
On ne peut pas dire que il y a contrôle. Les prisonniers sont effectivement dans la cour de la prison.
We can't say the prisoners are under control, he says, as they're in the prison courtyard. But he insists they're not outside and cannot get out because the place has been sealed off. He confirmed there have been casualties.
Il y a 13 blessés, mais les blessés, c'est pas nécessairement les blessés par balles.
He says 13 people have been wounded and evacuated from the area, but most do not have gunshot wounds as they were injured during the rioting in the jail. The incident is another sign of the chaos in the CAR, 20 months after Seleka rebels ousted the president. A transitional government has been unable to restore order or stop rampant violence and lawlessness around the country. Recently, the UN told VOA there used to be 60 prisons in the CAR, but many were damaged or destroyed by rebels over the past 2 years, and now only four of them are operational. Garagba prison was the biggest of those four, and for the time being, it too is out of service. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello, I'm Jimmy Carter. I would like to talk to you about stopping Ebola. Ebola spreads mostly by close contact with a person who is sick with Ebola and funeral practices that involve touching of bodies. Please help health workers check on people who have been in close contact with an Ebola patient. so they can get health care at the first sign of sickness. Working together, we can stop Ebola.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Ebola virus continues to the international community to contain it. And the U.S. and the U.N. are condemning increasing attacks against civilians in the DRC's North Kivu province. Coming up, we have music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, the World Health Organization says drowning is among the 10 leading causes of death for children and young people. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Impuga sitting in for Sunny Young today and the rest of the week. And happy Wednesday, Douglas.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
What's going on today?
Well, Kim, we kick off with the soccer.
Okay, great.
Thank you. There are growing calls for the World Soccer Governing Body, FIFA, to publish the full findings of its investigation into the 2018 and 2022 World Cup bidding process. The British Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, Sajid Javid, has now written to FIFA President Sepp Blatter, urging FIFA to make public the full report. FIFA has so far only published a 42-page summary of the investigation. According to media reports, Javid urges FIFA's handling of the report, in his words, further calls into question their independence and transparency. The summary report published on November 13th cleared Russia and Qatar of wrongdoing. However, U.S. Attorney Michael Garcia, who led the two-year investigation into the allegations, said it contained what he called numerous materially incomplete and erroneous representations. FIFA has since lost two big sponsors, most say as a result of this controversy. Sony Corporation of Japan and Emirates Airlines say they will not renew their sponsorships next year. Now on to Johannesburg, South Africa, where Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma has more, beginning with hockey.
In an all-Egyptian...
Fun to listen to him, fun to interview him. I like him to bring the power of John the Beast Mugabe. if he can bring a little bit of John the Beast Mugabe's power to add it to his repertoire, yes, he'll be a complete puncher, a complete boxer. But I like to see him, a little bit of John the Beast Mugabe, Cornelius Boza Edwards, Ayub Kalule, mix it in. Yes, we have a dangerous puncher from Africa.
Bogere now being promoted by Golden Boy Boxing, Namdi. How important is that to his career?
Very important for you to be aligned with the best promoter in the world because he can deliver TV dates. If you have a promoter who cannot give you good fights on TV, everything comes down to television, son. It's not about 100 people in the casino watching you fight and nobody. But when we talk about a fight with a reputable promoter, he puts you on Fox television. Millions will see you, not only in America, but around the globe. So you need that man that has the power and also can cut the check, because after the fight, your check is in the dressing room waiting for you.
Namdi, a couple of Nigerian fighters that you follow closely, Wally Omotoso and Latif Kayode. First, Wally, what's up with him?
Wally moved up from welterweight to junior middleweight, which is a super welterweight. He's no longer with Bob Arum. His promoter, his most recent promoter Dan Guzin suddenly died last month. So, but the family, Guzin family, they're moving forward with fights. So they just had one fight for Wally on Thursday right here in Hollywood. So Wally's back. Wally only lost one fight, you know. The fact that he only lost one fight and the promoter caught him loose, that kind of surprised us. But, hey, he's a good fighter. And now with his promotion company moving forward with fights for him in Hollywood, I think we'll see Playboy Omotosho come back soon, big time.
What about Latif Power Coyote Nnamdi? Last time we chatted, he was getting beat convincingly by a big Cuban.
Well, he got knocked out by Luis Ortiz. But after the fight, Luis Ortiz tested positive for banned substance, which means the result of that one-round knockout is null and void. So undefeated, but he needs to move down to the cruiserweight because the big boys are too strong for Latif Coyote. Though he has what we call Agbara, but that Agbara is not strong enough for the big boys.
Yes, Nnamdi, Hollywood Maweta, the reigning prince of pugilistics. He spoke with my colleague, Sunny Young. And that report brings us to the end of tonight's edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Now back to you, Kim.
Okay, thank you, the mighty Douglas Impuga. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the World Health Organization says drowning is among the 10 leading causes of death for children and young people. And next, we meet George Owusu, a Ghanaian philanthropist. But first, some music. Here is Joel of Ghana with One Man Down.
Used to cruise me around in your car, but thank God I got my own home. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that. So why you the envy? Used to pay my bills before, but now I they pay for two. And I thank you for that, I thank you for that, brother man, to the envy. Punya yanka, they be an ordinary size, I pay any baller. But man no be God, man no be God, stop all the hating. Lie, lie, man just be man, so you never know why. My destiny changing, I'm living so high. Make you no envy my shine, because where they bless me. Gunshots, one man down, on to the next one, oh yeah. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning. Gunshots, one man down, oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down, oh yeah, no turning. The DJs, they playing my song. The fellas be loving, they hailing my song. The ladies, they dancing, they using my song for their ringtone. You never thought about that. No man's there on top forever. Whether you short or you tall, rich or you poor, time keeps changing for better. And you can't do nothing about it. Another man ain't no fighting. Because you know be God. And you never saw be past God. Cause that one is no one on Yabala man. It does it when it feels just right. It don't you say it's never my type. So make you know they look down on another brother man. Ha. Let go. Gunshots. One man down. On to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Another man down. Oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down. Oh yeah, no gaba.
Said I would shrivel, said I'd be dead if I ever try to whistle. But hey, who said it was simple? The feds take your bread so you wouldn't make a nickel. You mean I couldn't pick a pickle? Pick words when I could've picked a pistol. A sick verse, the NSL's got him sickle. Blowing all up in your face like a pimple. Now he said, she said he ain't hit. And if he ain't hit, that's cause he ain't rich. And if he ain't rich, check who he came with. I don't play with this, he said, she said, shh. Get off my
one man crown. One man crown, another man frown. Wah, wah. Because him want you down. They say one man crown, and another man frown. Wah, wah. Because him want you down. But guess what? Gunshots. One man down, on to the next one. Oh yeah, no gaba. Hey, another man down. Oh yeah, no turning back. Gunshots. One man down. Oh yeah, no. Oh, yeah, no turning back.
Joe Wells of Ghana with One Man Down.
Well, the World Health Organization says drowning is among the 10 leading causes of death for children and young people. WHO's first ever global report on drowning highlights measures that individuals, communities, and nations can take to prevent the vast majority of drowning deaths that occur each year. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
Authors of this global report call drowning the biggest epidemic of which no one has ever heard. And this appears to be borne out by the steady stream of unnerving statistics presented in this study. The World Health Organization reports every year 372,000 people lose their lives from drowning, and 90% of these deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries. The highest rates are in the African, Southeast Asia, and Western Pacific regions. The data show more than half of all drowning deaths happen to those under age 25, with the highest rates among children under 5 years of age. It finds males are twice as likely to drown as females. Dr. Etienne Krug is WHO Director for the Department for Management of Noncommunicable Diseases, Disability, Violence, and Injury Prevention. He says every hour of every day, more than 40 people drown in circumstances both mundane and catastrophic.
These are often children in bathtubs or in watering holes and rivers, fishermen doing their daily work that are carried out at sea, migrants looking for a better life but losing it in perilous crossings, and capsized ferries, which result also in the drowning of scores of passengers in one time.
WHO scientist and lead author of the report, David Meddings, notes that people in poorer countries often encounter water in more dangerous circumstances.
In most high-income settings, when we talk about interacting with water, it's almost always on a recreational basis. We go to bodies of water to swim at a lake. We jump in a pool to cool off on a hot summer day. The reality for many populations, particularly those in rural parts of low- and middle-income countries, is a very, very different relationship with water. They need water for household chores, for cooking, for washing, for bathing. They need water frequently to make their employment in the act of, you know, small-scale fisheries, etc.
Meddings notes that long-term trends show drowning rates have dropped dramatically in rich countries over the past 70 to 80 years. This is due to factors such as better emergency care and people having water piped into their homes instead of having to use a lake or river. WHO urges communities and governments to put in place a number of simple, low-cost measures that it says would save many lives from drowning. These include installing barriers to control access to water, providing safe places such as daycare centers for children, teaching children basic swimming skills, and training bystanders in safe rescue and resuscitation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A small Texas oil company discovered offshore oil off the coast of Ghana and now earns millions for the nation. A key player in the discovery was George Owusu, who is now a multimillionaire living in Houston. He's retired from the oil business now and spends all of his time being a philanthropist for his homeland. Greg Flakus reports from Houston, Texas.
The man speaking in this clip from the documentary film Big Men is George Yao Owusu, who assisted Dallas-based Kosmos Energy in obtaining permission to drill an exploratory oil well off the coast of Ghana. There were a number of twists and turns in the story, including a change of government and an investigation of Kosmos and Owusu for allegedly bribing government officials. The investigation was ultimately dropped and Kosmos succeeded where many other companies had failed. Owusu says he's happy with what the oil boom has done for Ghana.
So it's been nothing but positive for the country, and I'm glad that I was a part of it.
He says Ghana has gone from producing negligible amounts of oil to producing more than 100,000 barrels a day, providing the nation with development funds and many well-paying jobs.
Ghana would see.
This boom was foreseen by Kosmos Energy's chief operating officer, Jim Musselman, when he visited Ghana in 2007.
We hope that we can serve you well, and we hope we lead to a lot of prosperity for this country.
Big Men director Rachel Boynton says this scene captured a moment of truth.
A lot of people in the oil business, and certainly the people that I filmed, do want to have a positive effect in the countries where they work. I think that's sincere.
Georgia Wusu says the film provides an accurate view of how the deep water drilling project came about.
We were busy doing our work, and here somebody's following you with a camera, and we didn't even know that it was going to come out the way it did. I was very, very pleased to see the final product.
The oil venture made Owusu a multimillionaire, but he's not forgotten his humble beginnings and the many children threatened by disease in Ghana.
I want to make sure that so many curable diseases, which are easily cured in the United States, make people go blind in Ghana and other parts of Africa. Make sure that at least we can help those people.
He's funding a number of projects in Ghana, including a new hospital in collaboration with Sanford Health, a Sioux Falls, South Dakota-based organization that already operates a number of clinics there.
It's going to be a $10 million hospital, and we have already committed $2 million out of it.
Thanks to the project he helped develop in Ghana, George Owusu has now retired from the energy industry and has become a full-time philanthropist. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month, the world celebrates a natural resource that provides employment opportunities for 50 million people and food for billions, fisheries. World Fisheries Day, established in 1998 and celebrated annually on November 21st, highlights the importance of protecting the oceans and conserving marine life. President Barack Obama and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry have made environmental sustainability a priority of U.S. foreign policy. They recognize the linkages between fisheries, food security, economic welfare, and people's health worldwide. In Africa, where more than 200 million people eat fish as a main source of protein, sustainable fishing is critical. The economic potential is also great. The fisheries sector employs more than 12 million Africans, and fish is a leading export, with an annual value of nearly $3 billion. Fisheries provide government revenues through fishing agreements and license fees from foreign fishing fleets, which also drive economic activity in regional ports. Protecting marine environments isn't just about fish, it's about people. Despite the resource's great importance, its health and sustainability face increasing challenges. Illegal and unregulated fishing is a major environmental problem and a form of wildlife trafficking. West African fisheries, one of the most diverse and economically important in the world, lose over $1 billion a year this way. The United States stands side by side with our African partners in addressing fisheries issues. 11 African countries joined nearly 90 nations at the Our Ocean Conference, hosted by Secretary Kerry in June, where sustainable fisheries were one of the key themes discussed. In September, Secretary Kerry joined Mozambican Foreign Minister Oldemiro Baloy and Director General of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, Jose Graziano, in hosting a follow-on meeting on the margins of the UN General Assembly. We applaud Gabon's announcement this month to create a 46,000 square kilometer network of marine protected areas in its waters. This bold step shows Gabon's strong commitment to marine habitats, important species, and local livelihoods. African countries also were key voices in developing the Port State Measures Agreement, an international treaty that will make it harder for fishing vessels to land illegal catches at ports around the world, ensuring that countries profit from fish caught in their waters. From providing food to generating income to keeping marine ecosystems healthy, fish are an indispensable natural resource. The United States is committed to improving fisheries management, protecting the ocean, and safeguarding this marine bounty for generations to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Heart, heart.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama addressing the Ebola crisis.
Ebola is actually a difficult disease to catch. It's not transmitted through the air like the flu. You cannot get it from just riding on a plane or a bus. The only way that a person can contract the disease is by coming into direct contact with the bodily fluids of somebody who is already showing symptoms. We know how to fight this disease. We know the protocols. And we know that when they're followed, they work. And if we take the steps that are necessary, if we're guided by the science, the facts, not fear, then I'm absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak here in the United States, and we can continue to lead the world in this urgent effort.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.